Is timing everything? As business leaders, we spend lots of attention on the who, the what, and the how of situations, but we tend to discount the importance of when.
People tend to move through the day in three stages: a peak, a trough, a recovery. What we should try to do is do our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during that trough period in the early afternoon, and our insight work, that is more creative, iterative kinds of things, later in the day.
That's New York Times bestselling author Daniel Pink. His books include Drive, A Whole New Mind, and most recently, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. In When, Dan shares the psychology, biology, and economics of timing. He makes the case for thinking of timing as not only an art, but also a science. His rich analysis shows that when we do things directly correlates to the quality of decisions we make in our lives.
Just as all times of day are not created equal, all dates are not created equal. There are certain dates of the year that operate as what are called temporal landmarks. They stand as landmarks in time the way that physical landmarks stand out in space.
I'm Merrill McDonald, and my passion is helping people and organizations navigate the human struggle of change. I believe that when we relinquish control, we open up amazing new possibilities. This podcast, Let Go and Lead, is about what happens when we loosen the reins. In it, I speak with business leaders, academics, and creative thinkers to hear about their career and life journeys and gather what they've learned about change, transformation, and creativity along the way. To kick off our second season, I'm thrilled to welcome Dan Pink. So we're here with Dan Pink. And Dan, your latest book, When, is all about timing. And I know you've shared thoughts on the perfect time, from everything of getting married to beginning a career and more. What was the biggest aha for you when you were researching the book?
There were a lot of ahas in this research, because what I was trying to do was look at all of the when decisions that we make in our life across that wide expanse of topics that you mentioned. I guess I was most surprised by how much our brain power changes over the course of a day. We tend to operate as if our brain power, our cognitive abilities, are more or less constant and steady over the course of a day. And the evidence tells us that is not true. Our brain power changes. It changes in material ways. It can change in pretty significant ways. And once we know how that operates, I think we can make better decisions within a day about when to do certain kinds of work.
Well, I was realizing, too, as I looked at the time we had on the calendar for this interview, that I recall in your book, you talked about the fact that the typical worker's most unproductive time is at 2:55 p.m. And here I am starting this with you at 3 o'clock, at least in my time zone.
Yeah, well, it's 4 here. I blew that. It's better for me.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I figured. And you'd pick the time. So good for you.
Yeah. I knew that like between 2 and 4 would be nasty. So I feel like I'm a little bit out of the worst part of the day.
Yeah, that's great. Well, what would you consider to be your top 3 timing tips for business leaders?
Well, so one of them would be understand the hidden pattern of the day and make decisions based on that. So what we know is that people tend to move through the day in three stages: a peak, a trough, a recovery. Most of us go through in that order. So we have a peak early in the day, our trough in the middle of the day, and our recovery later in the day. People who are night owls have their peak much, much later in the day. But what we should try to do is do our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during that trough period in the early afternoon, and our insight work, that is more creative, iterative kinds of things, later in the day. For people who are night owls, the most important thing is to do your analytic, heads down focus work in the late evening during your peak. So that would be one. The second takeaway, I guess, would be we've woefully undersold the importance of breaks. So what we should be doing is we should be taking more breaks, and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. So I would advise every business leader to schedule at least one, maybe two breaks in the afternoon, call up for 15 minutes. And what we know from the science of breaks is that breaks are more restorative when you are moving rather than stationary, when you're with somebody else rather than alone, when you're fully detached, that is, you're not looking at your phone, you're not talking about work, and when you're outside rather than inside. So if everybody took a 15-minute, at least one, maybe two, 15-minute walk breaks outside with someone they like, talking about something other than work and leaving their phones behind. I think that's an incredibly important leadership tool. And then another takeaway, I guess, would have to do with the more episodic nature of timing. Our lives are a series of episodes, and episodes have beginnings, they have middles, they have ends, and they each exert a different effect on our behavior. So another thing that you can do is pay very careful attention to the midpoints of things, of projects. If we're aware of midpoints, we can use them to fire us up. There's some good research, for instance, in the NBA, the National Basketball Association, showing that teams that are slightly behind at halftime are more likely to win than that are slightly ahead. So what I would do is I would pay attention to midpoints and bring them out to your team and explain why you're just a little bit behind, and that can galvanize people's motivation.
Why is that?
I don't know. It's a great question. What we know is this is some interesting research on teams that was done by Connie Gersick years ago, showing that when you had teams do a project and you actually watch what they actually did, and she ended up recording them by videotape and audio tape, what they actually did, that at the beginning of a project, teams did very, very little. There was some status seeking, some elbowing around, a lot of jabbering. But it was only at the temporal midpoint that things really got going. And people basically saying, hey, we wasted half of our time. We got to get moving here. I think what it shows is even at the episodic nature of time, forget about mornings, afternoons, and evenings, but even when we think about stages of time in a project, that all times are not created equal and that certain times have a bigger effect on us. We see a little bit of this effect with endings as well. Endings can be, when the end is in sight, we're more likely to act. And so this is a very sturdy finding in psychological science, goes back to the 1940s. And one interesting consequence of that, which I've always found fascinating, is that people are more likely to cash in gift certificates when they have less time to do it rather than when they have more. There's a famous experiment where they gave people gift certificates. They told one group, you have 3 weeks to cash it in. The other group, you had 2 months to cash it in. And the group that had less time was 5 times more likely to cash it in.
That reminds me of the saying that nothing focuses your thinking like a hanging in the morning.
You know what? That is actually taking endings to an even higher degree. Yeah. You're coupling the fear of mortality too. But there is something about when we see the end of something, we kick a little bit harder. And leaders can use that to galvanize their team into action.
And when you talked earlier about, taking restorative breaks, what do you think would change in business if leaders were more committed to that?
I think they'd get more done and they'd be less stressed out.
Yeah.
And those two things go hand in hand. At some level, we've gotten a lot of this wrong, Meryl. That is, we have this notion that the way to get more done, the way to get more work done, the way to get better work done, the way to be a true professional is simply to power through. And what the evidence tells us is that's just not correct. And this is something I got wrong, too. I mean, I'd always believed that amateurs took breaks and professionals didn't. And when you look at the research, it tells us that it's the exact opposite. The professionals take breaks. Amateurs are the ones who don't take breaks. At the same time, I do think that there is this weird fetishization of stress. So if people aren't running around like crazy people, if they're not acting stressed out, if they don't say, oh, I'm so busy, that they're not serious. And that's another ridiculousness. What we know is that that if you take breaks, that you'll get more work done and you'll get better work done.
I know you've also talked about the power of choral singing as being really great. As I understand it, it's from a synchronization standpoint.
Yeah, there's some very, very interesting research so there's a big body of research on how do groups synchronize in time. Whether they are people working together on a production line, whether people working together to some extent in the supply chain, whether they're people rowing together in a boat. But there's also a lot of research, as you say, on choral singing. And it turns out that choral singing, singing with other people, is incredibly good for us. It has an effect on our mood. So it can be a prophylactic against depression. It is an almost immediate mood booster. But it also has some physiological effects. It actually can strengthen our immune system. It can reduce our cortisol levels. And so, and what's important here is that it's not singing. Singing by yourself doesn't have these effects. It's singing with other people. There's something incredibly powerful when we synchronize and coordinate with other people. And choral singing ends up being one of the most robust, impressive ways to do that.
Did any of your research talk about what enables one to synchronize?
Sure. I mean, there are a few latent rules about that. So one of the things that's interesting about synchronization is that there's usually some kind of a boss, that there's a lot of autonomy in the system, but there's usually some kind of sort of leader, some kind of boss. And so if you look at something like rowing in teams, there's a coxswain who is shouting out the orders and the rowers are looking at that person. If you think about a choral group, there is a choral director, a choir master who is leading the whole thing and everyone's eyes are fixed on him or her. It's sort of interesting how similar those are in that in a boat, you have a coxswain who is the boss, but actually is the only one who's not touching an oar. In a choral group, you have the choral director, the chorus master, who is also facing a different direction from everybody else and not making a sound. So there's something about sort of having some kind of boss that seems to be valuable. Another thing that helps out is a sense of belonging. When people feel that choral singing and other kinds of synchronization depend on a sense of belonging, but also foster a sense of belonging. And then also having a sense of purpose also seems to help people synchronize at a deeper level. So there are, exactly as you say, some underlying rules that help groups synchronize. And having a boss, having some sense of belonging, and then having a purpose of the exercise.
So Dan, how would you relate that to a corporate leader and what they ought to be thinking about?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things. If you look at some of the research just on how teams cohere, even if they're not, you know, moving in exact temporal synchrony, some of the principles are very, very clear. So belonging is an enormously important part of how groups mesh. When people feel like, and it's connected to another principle called psychological safety. So what allows groups to perform at their best is people feel safe. They don't feel complacent, but they feel like, hey, I can say something, I can take an action, and no one's going to bite my head off. My boss is going to have my back. So psychological safety is important. A sense of belonging, so that I belong here, I'm part of this. And then also, which comes out in a number of different levels of research, is that people need to know why they're doing something in the first place. So you can tell a team, you know, do it this way. But if they don't know why they're engaged in this enterprise at all, you know, to begin with, you're not going to get the same kind of performance. So psychological safety is incredibly important. Belonging is incredibly important. A sense of purpose is incredibly important. Tied to the psychological safety is having a boss that has your back. Turns out to be a really good predictor of how teams cohere. But the other thing is that, you know, actual synchronization is actually pretty powerful. When we synchronize in time with other people, we actually feel better and we actually become slightly better people. We actually are more likely to do good deeds and help out others and engage in other pro-social behavior.
I just think that's so fascinating and such a great analogy. And now I'm going back. You talked about the beginnings, the middle, and the endings. What about beginnings and endings can serve as accelerators or decelerators?
Well, let's think about it from the leader's point of view once again. Let's say we're starting some kind of change initiative internally. Once again, all dates are not created equal. Just as all times of day are not created equal, all dates are not created equal. There are certain dates of the year that operate as what are called temporal landmarks. And so they stand as landmarks in time the way that physical landmarks stand out in space. And they get us to slow down and consider. They also get us to do this weird kind of mental accounting, where when we hit one of those certain dates, we essentially open up a fresh ledger on ourselves. So this is the work of Heng Chen Dai, Jason Rees, and Katie Milkman, showing what's called the fresh start effect, that people are more likely to change their behavior, say, start going to the gym on these temporal landmarks. So I think the lesson for leaders is that if you're going to make a change initiative, you're going to have a slightly better chance if you pick the right day, if you pick the right when for launching that initiative. So Mondays are better than Thursdays. The first of the month is better than the 13th of the month. The day after a milestone is better than 2 days before a milestone.
And do you know why that is? Or does the research show it?
It's a sort of a trick that we play on ourselves, in that what we do is that we get to these dates and we use them as a way to trick ourselves, essentially, to, as I said before, to, you know, you think about a business, coming to a new fiscal year, right? And think about the old school businesses that actually had not computers, but paper ledgers, right? Think about a ledger, a physical ledger. They would open up a fresh ledger at the beginning of a quarter, at the beginning of a year. And on some of these fresh start dates, that's what we do mentally. We say, well, old me didn't exercise regularly, but I'm going to banish old me to last quarter. And now on this fresh start date, I'm going to open up a fresh ledger on new me.
Got it. I also thought it was interesting that you've talked about how people's peaks shift during the day with age. So how do you recommend structuring work time with, if a leader's thinking about having all kinds of employees at various generations,
yeah,
how do you really schedule the work?
I think what's important is giving people discretion over when they work and not coming in with a one-size-fits-all strategy. So one of the factors in determining what the best time of day is to do something goes to what's called our chronotype, which is, do we wake up early and go to sleep early? Do we wake up late and go to sleep late? And what we know across the population is that about 15% of us are very strong morning people, larks. About 20% of us are very strong evening people, owls. And about 2/3 of us are in the middle, but kind of leaning a little bit toward the larky side. And so what we know is, I mean, I'm oversimplifying a bit, Meryl, but maybe 80% of the population moves through the day as I suggested. Peak early in the day, trough in the middle of the day, recovery later in the day.
And then how would that relate to age?
Well, there's some changes in chronotype over time, for instance. So little kids are very larky. Between the mid-teens and the mid-20s, there's a massive move toward lateness. So people, say, between 14 or 15 and 24 or 25 tend to be very night-owly. And so if you're hiring a lot of young people like that, you're probably going to have a disproportionate number of owls. And then in general, over time, as people age, they return toward to greater and greater larkiness. That's not true of every single person because we still have 20% of the population that are hardcore night owls. So what matters less than age is really just allowing people to figure out for themselves when they're at their best.
Which makes perfect sense. Yeah, we have a philosophy at the firm of be where you need to be for exactly that reason.
Yeah, not everybody's that enlightened. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, there are a lot of places where it's like, if you're not at your desk at 8:30, you're a slacker. And
right.
You know, there are plenty of people out there who are absolutely not doing their best work at 8:30 in the morning. They might be doing their best work at 8:30 in the evening, but if they're required to just show their face early in the morning, they're not going to be around at 8:30 in the evening when they're able to do their very best work.
Right. And, you know, this kind of reminds me, too, of it kind of takes me back to when I first started to follow you and fell in love with your work with the Fast Company article you did on Free Agent Nation, which then, of course, led to a book. What have you really thought about differently since you first published that article?
Oh, my God. So what I thought about differently with regard to like the topic of free agency and all that?
In the topic, the whole autonomy and people having freedom to work the way they work.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there are many, that the human beings by their nature want to be self-directed, want to have some sovereignty over their lives. I think that's our natural condition. I don't think that everybody necessarily has that. I think people, learn behaviors of compliance, but I think that's our natural state. If you look at, say, any 2-year-old or 4-year-old, every 2-year-old I know is self-directed. Every 4-year-old I know is self-directed. I think that's how we are. Circumstances, though, can make us less self-directed. So I do think that autonomy and self-direction are part of the human condition, even if they're not always expressed in people's day-to-day lives. You know, I think that threads through a lot of the research and a lot of the best practices. At the same time, you want to marry some degree of self-direction with some degree of unity. This is what we were talking about before with a sense of purpose and even a sense of belonging. So if people have a sense of belonging and a sense of self-direction, then I think they're able to do their very, very, very best work. One of the interesting things that's happened since all that time that I wrote that book, which is now almost 20 years, is how much the technology has changed. Back then, I said, technology is enabling people to go off and do their own thing. It's kind of amazing that, how much things have changed. I mean, I did that before. I wrote that before widespread broadband. There was not widespread Wi-Fi. There were not smartphones. There was not social media. It's just incredible to me. And so so what you have now is technology enabling people to, more easily do their own thing. It's an enabler. It doesn't mean that that's the right choice for every single person. One of the things that we see that was, I think, true then, even truer now, is that what matters less is whether you're, a free agent or a W-2 employee. If you have skills that are in demand, you're going to be fine. If you don't have skills that are in demand, you're going to be in a world of hurt.
Right. And, I think about it, and you were really, at least in my awareness, one of the first authors to start writing about the future of work. And here we are 20 years later. What do you now think will be the future of work?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can talk with any specificity. Because I think that if you look at people forecasting at any degree of granularity, they're almost always wrong. I actually worked in the U.S. Department of Labor in the early 1990s. And, there are projections from the late 1980s. So we're going back a long time now. So we're going back 30 years. Projections from the late 1980s that two of the biggest jobs of the 90s would be data entry clerks. Okay. Because no one envisioned everybody having a computer on their desk. And then also they envisioned, you got a population that's getting older and wealthier. They're going to be, explosion in the number of travel agents because someone's going to need to book all this travel. When in fact, what happened was that a lot of the travel stuff went online. So like there's no way on God's green earth, I'm going to go there and say, oh, this is going to be a very valuable profession later, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. I think what we know is that at the center of it is that people are going to have to be able to do things that augment machine intelligence rather than compete with it. I think that seems to be pretty clear. I do think that there's going to be a premium on skills that are difficult to outsource and automate, which tends to be these more, at least for now, these more artistic, empathic kinds of abilities. And it seems like labor markets are becoming even more winner take all, and that the divide between people who have skills in demand and people that don't have skills is growing even greater. But the idea that the job of the future is a lunar genetic counselor seems kind of crazy. You're going to be working on the moon doing genetic counseling by looking at people's stem cells. I mean, who knows?
Well, a lot of the things you just talked about, of course, you wrote about in your book, A Whole New Mind, which I would highly recommend to our listeners if they haven't read it, because that's a terrific book, too.
Thank you.
So you've written several books, like I know When, A Whole New Mind, Drive to Sell as Human, Free Agent Nation. Did you have one in particular that was your favorite?
That's like asking me if one of my kids is my favorite. And no, I love them all.
I love them too. So now I know you're doing a lot in terms of curating books with your next big idea club with Susan Cain, Adam Grant, Malcolm Gladwell. What's the dynamic between the four of you?
You know what? We discuss it almost always online via email. So it's not like we convene and go away. It's not like we go up into the hills and then when there's white smoke, we have a choice. When a white smoke comes out of the chimney, we have a choice. It's pretty mellow. We haven't had very many deep disagreements out there at all. Those other three are just terrific, really smart, really good people who care about books, who care about ideas, and they're just a delight to work with.
And do you have a set of criteria against which you recommend books to one another, or how does that work?
We do not. We don't have like a checklist or a rubric or anything like that. It's just a matter of, I think maybe internally we might each have a different way of approaching it, but nothing ever specified. For me, what I always look for in one of these things is that if I read the book, do I start seeing the world differently now that I've read it than when I hadn't read it? I mean, we get a lot of books and most of them are not very good. And every once in a while you get a book like Biased by Jennifer Eberhardt, or you get a book like Range by David Epstein that are just extraordinary, and you start seeing the world completely differently now that you've read it.
I know you read a lot and you recommend a lot as well in your newsletter and your podcasts, et cetera. And you've been described as a cultural critic. What do you think about that?
I don't know who described me as that, because I would never describe me that way.
Oh, okay. Well, that answered my next question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know who would say. Yeah. Yeah.
I wish I could tattle on him, yeah, but I can't remember.
Really, I'm not real. Yeah. I mean, I'm not real. You know, it's like, no, I'm just a dude who's like, I'm a writer. I honestly, Meryl, I've never called myself that, and I can't imagine I ever would.
Yeah, I've heard you called a cultural anthropologist also, which I love.
I like that better. I'm not, because a cultural anthropologist is actually a real profession built on a real body of knowledge and a set of methodologies. Right. But like, I like that. I appreciate that. Sort of a, you know, a poor man's anthropologist. That's cool. I'll take that.
So what's exciting you or inspiring you now? Like, what are you thinking about next?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to, you know, writing a book is a gigantic pain in the neck. It takes a lot of time, a lot of sweat. And so I tend to vet my ideas pretty carefully. There have been a couple of things I've been working on this summer that I ended up saying, you know what, this is not good enough for a book. And so doing, you know, research on a couple of topics and finally saying, I don't think I want to do this. So I'm looking around for my own next big idea. But again, you know, I always have a running list of ideas of projects that I want to work on. And when I'm in between projects, I'll, you know, take out the list and just systematically go over them and say, okay, let me see about this one. Let me see about that one. So I got a lot more on the list that I'm working through.
Well, we're looking forward to the next book. That's for sure.
So is my beleaguered publisher.
Well, so one last thing I do want to ask you is, what do you think leaders most need to let go of?
Great question. I think it's control. And it goes to some of what you were talking about earlier, Meryl, about autonomy. One way to understand autonomy is to think about the opposite, and that is control. And if you look at human beings again, human beings have only two reactions to control. They comply or they defy. And I don't think there's a leader out there who wants people who are always compliant. And I know that there are leaders out there. There aren't many leaders out there who want people who are totally defiant. What you want is you want people who are engaged. And the way that people engage is through self-direction. And so I really think that control is very addictive for leaders, but it is not the pathway to helping people do their great work. The way that people will do their great work is if they have some degree of self-direction, if they're getting better at something that matters, if they know the boss has their back, if they have a sense of belonging, if they have a sense of psychological safety, and if they have a sense of purpose. That's how people do their best work.
Yeah. And, you know, from my experience, though, not deep research, most people, when they go to a position of control, it's because they are having their own issue of psychological safety, or they're fearful of something. Oh. Does the research pan out?
I don't know, but I would share your hypothesis. And if there were a casino that would allow bets on that kind of research, I would put a very heavy bet that you were right.
So I think I'm pretty much wrapped up, other than to just ask you, what else should I ask you?
Well, you covered a lot of ground. I don't know what else.
Okay, well, thank you so much. This is Dan Pink. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Meryl.
I never fail to be inspired by the practical wisdom of Dan Pink. Here are my top takeaways from our conversation. First, as leaders, we should be mindful of our peak, trough, and recovery periods throughout the day. Dan suggests tackling our analytical work during the peak, our administrative work in the midday trough, and insightful creative work during our recovery period later in the day. However, for you night owls, do your analytical work during your peak, which is the evening. Second, use midpoints and temporal landmarks to your advantage. Midpoints are a good time to do a pulse check and galvanize your team. And using temporal landmarks can help create organizational energy and build momentum. Third, business leaders can learn from choral singers. Who knew? Synchronized choral singing has three elements that we can apply to our work lives. A boss who's seen as valuable, a sense of belonging, and a clear sense of purpose. As leaders, if you can create this kind of environment for your team, you're setting everyone up for success. Lastly, remember that autonomy and self-direction are part of the human condition. In marrying self-direction with a feeling of unity, you can create a framework in which people can thrive. Thanks again to Dan for the fantastic conversation. To continue the dialogue, check out our episode discussion guides at letgoandlead.com. And please subscribe to make sure you receive new episodes automatically. Special thanks again to Dan Pink. This is Let Go and Lead.